following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com. FlyPod.com, I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Hi, welcome to Cover to Cover. I'm Mark DeWitt. Today, well, he's got a brand new book. It's called Shrink Thyself. Bill Schaft. Bill, he is not only an author, but he's been the writer of the David Letterman Show for eons. Bill, welcome.
I was with the show for 24 years, but here, before we continue, I just want to say that I prefer radio to television, but I wish we were on television so the viewing audience could see this giant, permanent Starbucks Vente container with the metal straw. It looks like something that you would get if you won the Starbucks Open. It doesn't. It looks like a trophy, but it's really magnificent to see.
And we'll just say, well, I have water in it.
Yeah, but it don't matter. It don't matter. It's just great looking.
Now, of course, Starbucks has your address, so they can start sending you freebies, right?
Absolutely. All right, absolutely.
So there you go. Well, you know, we have a brand new book out. What book is this?
This is my fourth novel and my fifth book. I published a collection. I was a columnist at Sports Illustrated for 3 years. And I published a collection in 2005 called The Best of the Show, which was a collection of my columns. So that and four novels. So this is novel number four.
Okay, the columns were from the New York Times?
No. I worked at Sports Illustrated as a columnist. I had a weekly column at Sports Illustrated for 3 years called The Show, which was just topical jokes about sports. And it ran for 3 years, and it was I loved it. It was a perfect combination of all my careers, which was I started as a sports writer, I became a stand-up comic, and then I became a writer on The Letterman Show. So it was ideal for me.
Well, you know, you must know a lot about sports, probably a big sports fan. What do you think of fantasy sports?
I think that it is, I give them a lot of credit for absolutely finding the giant loophole in gambling, because nothing about fantasy sports has to do with the outcome of the game. You're just, you know, you're just in charge of players. And many times you have two players face off against each other. You have a pitcher face a batter. You have a runner go up against a defender. And so that's brilliant. I know that DraftKings advertising budget this year is bigger than McDonald's. And I think that the NFL is outraged by all of this because they don't have a piece of it. So that's what I think about fantasy sports.
That's pretty good. So, yeah, and I'm wondering, you know, there are a lot of states, if they didn't get on the bandwagon for sports booking, do you think that might come about now because of DraftKings and other fantasy sports?
I think it's going to render traditional gambling obsolete, because you're not going to have to. There's no chance for games being fixed now, because it's just all about statistics. It's thoroughly based on statistics, and it also they've able to successfully argue that there is skill involved with picking fantasy teams. And although, you know, as a degenerate gambler, as somebody that hasn't made a bet in 20 years, you know, the notion of skill and determining things is always a little dubious. But it really is amazing the way it's grown. And the other thing about it is it's totally trapped the non-sports fan. You know, there was a line in The Old Odd Couple in the series where Oscar says to Felix, you know, this is when they go in on a greyhound racing dog. He says, you know, when I was a sports writer, I didn't want to be a sports writer. I wanted to be Joe Namath. If I couldn't be Joe Namath, I wanted to own Joe Namath. And now I'm down to like a greyhound racing dog. And so it's, if you can't be an athlete, you can own Aaron Rodgers, or you can, you know.
All right. Well, let's talk about your book, Shrink Thyself. I don't think it's really one of those Mother, I Shrunk the Kids books.
No, it's not. It's about a guy that tries to, who ends therapy and tries to live a non-psychological life. He tries to live an unexamined life. He tries to live just in the moment. And I came up with this. There's two ways that I came up with this. First, in my previous three novels, I had always had at least one or two unorthodox, crazy psychotherapists because they were so interesting to write, and I always found them a lot of fun to write. And secondly, it was based on my wife, who's a comedian, Adrienne Tulsh. She had been in therapy for a while, and she had finished, and she liked her therapist, and they would go out to dinner like every 6 months. And when they started going out to dinner, he was telling her stuff like, well, you know, my wife and I think we're, you know, we're going to split up and I'm getting a place of my own. And it was stuff that is so thoroughly inappropriate if they had been seeing each other. But I thought that this was a tremendous idea for a book. And so I thought, well, why don't we have a guy that leaves therapy, tries to become stay friends with his therapist, but his therapist is so beyond inappropriate. And basically what happens is the second this guy decides to leave therapy, things begin to happen to him, which would send anybody else screaming back into therapy. You know, his therapist is wildly inappropriate, crosses all kinds of boundaries. His mother dies in a way that would have Freud transfer to dental school. And just all these things pile up, and yet he continues to try and forge ahead.
Well, you know, I thought it was kind of funny because the therapist steals his fantasy.
That's right. That's right. And that's exactly, and I thought, what could be more inappropriate or more boundary crossing than something that you shared in the strictest of confidence, and all of a sudden your therapist becomes so titillated by it that he decides to pursue it. And I just got a big kick out of that. And of course, we're just giving away a little slice because there are twists and turns, as there always are. You know, he ends up, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, in this book, he ends up going back to see his therapist, but their sessions take place in the lock ward of a mental hospital. So all these kind of things happen, as they do in my books, just twists and turns and a lot of laughs and just behavior.
You know, you talked about the mother dying. I don't want to, like you, I don't want to give much away of the book. But thinking about even my parents, you know, they live far away and my brother's there. What if one of them die? How do you ask? I mean,
right.
How do they feel about telling you, you know?
Right, right. And you know, and I'll never forget, you know, my father died. My mother's still alive. My mother's 92. And she lives in the joint, as we say. No, she lives in a wonderful facility in Bedford, Massachusetts. I grew up in Boston. And my father died 7 years ago. And I'm at the funeral. In the funeral, it was a graveside ceremony. And it's about to start. And I'm talking, a friend of mine called to see how I was, very sweet, before the ceremony begins. And I'm the fifth of six children. It was a large Jewish family. There was never enough guilt to go around. So I get off the phone with him, and I go, oh, my, the service is about to begin. I got to see if mom's okay. And I started walking towards my mother, and she had all these people around her, and the service is about to begin. This is this woman who is now widowed, and I'm walking. I hope she's all right. And as I'm about 20 feet from her, she throws her head back and laughs so loud just before the ceremony is supposed to start. I thought, oh, she's doing all right. She's okay.
All right. Shrink Thyself, of course, novel number four, but
correct.
Book number five. Right. Kind of explain that a little more. I know
the best of the show was a collection of my columns. So that was not a novel. That was just a collection. And that was published in 2005. My first book was The Ringer. My first novel, that was published in 2002. It was about a guy that tries to make a living playing softball in New York City. And my second book was called Time Won't Let Me, about a prep school garage band that tries to reunite 30 years after it finds out that the only album that they made is now worth $10,000. That's 2005. 2009 was Everything Hurts. It was about a guy trying to get rid of a psychosomatic limp and the lengths that he goes to. And now we're up to Shrink Thyself.
So the very first, the columns in the first book kind of had...
No, that was the third book. The first book was The Ringer, 2002. Let's run it again. Ringer, 2002. Time Won't Let Me, 2005. The Best of the Show, 2005. Everything Hurts, 2009. Shrink Thyself.
The Ringer had that sports background, I guess, to it. Is that correct?
All my books have a little bit of sports in it. The Ringer more than the others. You know, I write what I know, and I was a pretty good softball player for years in New York, and I decided to see if I could write a book about a guy that makes a living playing for 16 different teams, and what happens as he gets older. His life changes because he gets older, and his life changes because his uncle, who is a very famous sports writer, like my uncle was, gets sick, and he has to take care of him. So it's a guy that doesn't want to grow up, and all of a sudden he has to grow up. So that was the ringer. But there's always a little bit of sports. There's always New York, Boston, sports, crazy shrinks, and getting older. And if you ever forget you're a Jew, a Gentile will remind you. It's, you know, there's always those themes that run through my books.
What was the first time that you wrote a novel? What was the challenge? I mean, here you are writing columns of taking maybe that art and putting it into a full-length novel.
Okay, this is a great question. I never thought that I had the gene in me to write a book because all I had ever written were jokes, scripts. I was a newspaper writer for a couple of years, columns, game stories. And I had never written anything longer. Well, I'd written a couple of screenplays. That's 120 pages, but that's no book. And I just said, okay, well, I'm destined to live a life writing in installments. And I've been working on The Letterman Show, about 3 years. And 4 years, actually. And my wife bought me a book called The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron, which millions of people have bought it, and I'm just one of a million people whose life it has changed. And it's a spiritual approach to creativity. And I started doing the work in this book and started doing these morning pages, which you write every morning, 3 pages once you get up. So she brought me that book in July of 1995. In August of 1995, I started doing the morning pages. In October of 1995, I stopped gambling. In November of 1995, I stopped drinking. And in December of 1995, I started writing my first novel. And that did not get published. That was a book called Who Listens. It was a typical first novel. It was 110,000 words, 80,000 of which were I. And it's everybody's first novel. But once I had gone through the process and shown myself I could do it, I said, I like doing this, and I know I'm going to get better. And so the next book was The Ringer, and that got published, and I've been very lucky.
Now let's talk a little bit about the David Letterman Show. You've been on that David Letterman Show, of course, now it's gone away.
Right.
You were on there.
I read
over
something about that it had gone away.
You did. Yeah. You showed up one day, and doors were locked, right?
Boy, I'll tell you, the day we stopped, our last show was May 20th, which was a Wednesday. Thursday morning at 8 a.m., the bulldozer came and they pulled all those seats out of the Ed. I mean, it wasn't even, the body was not even cold. They went, they had to rip up the whole place to get it ready for Stephen Colbert because they only had 3 months to do it. And but that was sort of jarring to see that we couldn't even really linger on it.
So who was maybe one of your favorite guests ever on the show?
I have several. I think that Martin Short was a great guest. Alec Baldwin was a great guest. Jennifer Lawrence was a tremendous guest. Julia Roberts. I like the people that are particularly fond of Dave and that he could very easily have a conversation with and understood their obligation as guests, not just to promote some movie or not just to be taken care of, but that their obligation to engage in a conversation that was, worth the viewer for the viewer to look at. So those are the ones that come to mind.
So when David does a show, an interview, Does he have notes? Is everything right off the top of his head?
No. Well, I mean, a lot of it is. Well, and I've said this a million times about as a writer on the show. We write a lot. We wrote a lot of stuff that was funny. We wrote a lot of stuff that was okay. We wrote a lot of stuff that was lame. But invariably, the funniest moments on every show would be Dave reacting in the moment, and that was something that you couldn't write. But all the guests are pre-interviewed. All the segments are produced, and all that is just a template from which Dave could work off of. And sometimes he asked every single question, and sometimes he asked none of the questions. But he was open enough to see which way the thing was going. You know, there's the famous clip of him with Paris Hilton when he kept asking her about being in jail, and Paris said, "Could you please stop asking me about jail? I really don't want to talk about it." And Dave said, "Well, see, that's the difference between you and me. That's all I want to talk about." And that got a big laugh. And then she started to cry. And he went, "Oh, don't cry." And somebody in the balcony yelled out, "I love you." And Dave said, "Is that somebody you met in prison?" Now, the two lines that got the big laugh, nobody wrote. They weren't on any sheet. And that's an example of why he was as good at it as he was.
Growing up, I used to watch the Dick Van Dyke Show, and of course, they had that tank of writers, three writers, I believe. Is that something like it is on a show like
no,
that?
No, people or? Often, the people that show, people say, "Do you guys all sit around a table?" Now, there's a meeting in the morning where they would sit around a table just to get different extras assigned, but that's more what they do in a sitcom. In a sitcom, a guy writes a script, and then they bring it into the table, and all the other writers work on the script, and they break it down line by line. But we don't have that luxury. When you work on a strip show, a show that's 5 days a week, you have to produce a lot of material. And the thinking is, rightfully so, that 10 guys in 10 rooms are going to come up with more material than 10 guys in one room. The only time we would gather around the table was when it was an emergency, you know, when things jumped off at the last minute, when you know, somebody resigned or something would happen and we'd have to change the top 10. But it's a popular misconception.
Yeah, to me it seems like it would be funnier to have maybe 5 guys or so around a table bouncing things.
Well, it is, but you don't have that kind of time because you're doing a show every night. Any of the other shows will tell you this. Of the amount of material that's generated, only 10% makes it to air. So you've got to create a lot of stuff. There are times when we would gather around the table, but that was only to get out of a jam. And that was only the first thing in the morning. That was a 15 or 20 minute meeting where they would go around the table and one writer would say, "Okay, I have this idea for, you know, for these interrupts that we would do during the monologues, these tape and live interrupts. I have this idea that," and then the head writer would say, "Okay, I'll do that one, do that one, do that one." And we put 6 into production. But that was what that was.
So take me in the day of a life of Bill Schaft. I mean, you probably have to find out what's going on in the world because, you know.
Well, not anymore. Not since May 20th. I don't have to care about it. You know, Gerard Mulligan, who was with the Letterman show from 1980. He was with his morning show till 2004, and he retired in 2004. And he was a great guy and a funny guy and a really good writer. And I'll never forget, he retired in 2004, and he came back to the building about 6 months after he retired. And he came into my office, and he said, "You know what the best thing about being retired is? I don't have to care what Lindsay Lohan did, who she's with, what happened. I don't have to care about the Kardashians. I don't have to care about..." And that's, you know, that's the thing. So my life is very different in the last 4 months. But back then, when I was working on the monologue, and things have really changed over the last 24 years because I no longer had to read 5 or 6 newspapers a day. You know, the news was in the air. That's the thing about the internet, is that you know what the news is and you know what topics you want to take on. And you're just sort of free associating off those topics. Because we're not, you know, we were never in the education business. We were in the humor business. So, like, for instance, as we speak today, they had the hearings on Planned Parenthood. So I don't need to know, as a joke writer, I don't need to know what happened in those. As a citizen, I need to know, but not as a joke writer. All I need to know is, how can I write a joke that ends on Planned Parenthood, where Planned Parenthood is going to get the laugh? So I don't need any information about videos, or I don't need any information about Ann Richards' daughter. I don't need any All I need to do is open my mind and think, how am I going to come up with something that ends with Planned Parenthood?
All through the David Letterman show, what was probably your favorite monologue that you came up with?
I'll tell you, my favorite joke of the last couple of years, and this is one I convinced him to do, was when Pope Francis, Pope Francis said, this is about a year ago, he said that he would not judge gay priests. But I believe his exact words were, "Let he who is without sin cast the first musical." That's my favorite joke of the last few years that I came up with. I was very proud of that, and I talked him into doing it, and he did it, and it got a nice laugh.
There you go. Well, you know, talking about laughter, your wife, a comedian.
Wonderful. That's how we met. We met at Catch a Rising Star in 1980. I was a comedian for 13 years, and that's how we met. And she's, you know, still working and really, really funny and loves being up there. You know, I didn't. I did it because I could make a living at it, and I always just wanted to be a writer.
So, you know, with her, does she come to you for jokes? She writes her own?
People ask this all the time. Do you write for your wife? I said, this is how I write for my wife. Every time she says something funny, I say, write that down. That's how I, yeah. No, she's perfectly incapable without me. And every once in a while, my job is to make sure that she remembers the things that she says. And every once in a while, I might give her, well, why don't you change this word to that word, or something like that.
Have an editor.
Yeah. And that's what you learn, you know, because I ran the monologue for so long, you learn how to put the top on anything or edit jokes. But she does fine without me.
Well, you have to have timing also. That's the biggest part, I guess.
She does a joke about, she says, I've gone out with a lot of Jewish guys. She says, I went out with a guy who was so Jewish, he lived with another guy's mother. I mean, you know, if I live to be 100, I'll never write a line that good.
All right. Well, of course, the brand new book, Shrink Thyself. What's next?
I'm writing a sequel to The Ringer called Through the Ringer, where we visit the Ringer college boy. It's 15 years later, and how his life has changed, and trying to answer the question, can a guy be a ringer twice in the same lifetime? You know, Ted Williams was, there's never been anybody like Ted Williams, because he was the greatest at three things. He was the greatest hitter that ever lived. He was the greatest fighter pilot that ever lived. And he was the greatest fisherman that ever lived. I mean, all this is arguable, but he's in the conversation and all that. So, I'm about halfway through that. And I also, and maybe your listeners are interested, there's a wonderful new site called HollywoodDementia.com. This was started by a woman named Nikki Fink, who ran the Deadline Hollywood website, and she started this website a few months ago, and it's all it is short fiction about show business. And I've been lucky enough to have four pieces in. They're all centered around the same character, Tommy Dash, this bitter old, bitter middle-aged comic, and I'm having a ball with that. I've written four installments, and if you can write four, you can write 10. If you can write 10, you can write 20. And if you can write 20, you got another book. So those are the two things I'm working on right now. And I just finished a pilot for a TV show based on Shrink Thyself, which my buddy Jeff Stilson, who's a big producer, is going to try and get made. So exciting time. So I'm plenty busy. I can't believe I fit in a job all these years.
Well, you know, as a sports writer, who was probably one of your most favorite sports people you ever interviewed?
Well, the biggest influence on me was my uncle, Herbert Warren Wind, who wrote for the New Yorker for 40 years, is the dean of American golf writers, and invented the phrase Amen Corner to describe the 11th, 12th, and 13th holes at the Masters. So he's my biggest influence. I covered a lot of people. This is a long time ago. I did the first big piece on Phil Sims right after he was drafted by the Giants, and he and I were the same age, and the Giants wouldn't let anybody interview him, but I sort of wrangled. I had a friend on the team, and he got me inside with Phil. So we're at training camp. This is a great story. And I'm sitting with Phil Sims, and it's going nowhere. I mean, I'm nervous, and he's giving me one-word answers. And after about 5 minutes, I say to him, I am so sorry. I just graduated from college. This is my first big piece, and I'm really not doing a very good job. I apologize. And Phil Sims says to me, well, how do you think I feel? I'm not even going to be starting quarterback on this team. And he totally opened up. So we talked for about 20 minutes or a half hour. He gave me every, it was wonderful. And at the end, he stood up and he said to me, will you do me a favor? When you're finished with this, will you send it to my mother in Kentucky? He was from Moorhead. He went to Moorhead State in Kentucky. And I said, absolutely. So it comes out, and it's nice. It was in Albany, New York, where I was working after college. By the way, if you've been to Albany, it's not some of God's best work. And so the piece comes out, and it's great, and people say nice things. So that's 1979, okay? Now, cut to 1986. I'm no longer a sports writer. I'm the MC at Catch a Rising Star. The Giants had just won the Super Bowl, and one of the doormen, I'm emceeing, and he says to me, hey, Phil Sims came in with his agent tonight, and they're sitting in them. So I'm emceeing, I bring up the axe, I'm doing my axe. So finally, I get a little bit of a break. No, he leaves. That's right, he leaves after about an hour and a half, 2 hours. And he's walking out, and I go up to him, and I said, Phil, I don't know if you remember me. My name is Bill Schecht, and I interviewed you years ago. He said, of course I remember you, Bill. You were the only guy of all the people that have written about me who I asked to send a copy of the article to my mother, who did. And his mother sent me a thank you note after. He said, you're the only guy that ever did that. And we've remained friends. So he's as good a guy as you can be. So that's, I think about him.
That's a great story. Well, you know, before we leave, I want to find out about a website, your website. How about your wife's website also?
I'm at billschecht.com, billschecht.com. My wife is adriantolsch.com, adriantolsch.com. She's on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. And my band, The Truants, named for the band in my second book, Time Won't Let Me, we play all over the East Coast. We play British Invasion and Garage Rock and nothing after 1967. And we're great, by the way. Life is good for a 58-year-old guy.
There you go. If you're on the East Coast, check out that band. Check out Shrink Thyself,
please.
A novel by Phil Schecht.
This is my fourth, and I'm really proud of it. You know, you love all your babies. But this one I'm really proud of. I think it's my best.
Oh, yeah. It is a fantastic read. Bill, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Bill Schecht, author of Shrink Thyself. To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.